Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, we're going to go all the way back to development of the Texar Audio Prism. Do you remember that? If you do, great. If you don't, you need to know about it. Brian Kirkin and Jim Hogue with WPOZ in Orlando join us with words from the past and advice for the future on Torts. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store with outstanding service, savings, and support online at bgs.cc. By the Ruby console from Lavo. See Lavo in your future at lavo.com/twert. By Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by the Calrec Type R console system. Type R is a brand new, modular, expandable IP-based radio system from Calrec Audio. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. And we talk about radio stuff. And as I said, light bulb, top of the tower, and all the things in between. And today, I'm delighted that our guests are really experienced in all the stuff in between. A couple of radio professionals are our guest today. I'll introduce them in just a minute. Chris Tobin can't be here today. He is putting out a fire. Well, not literally, but, you know, a radio fire. So Chris will be back next week when we're talking with Tracy Teagarden. Tracy Teagarden's our guest next week. But anyway, I'm Kirk Harnack. I'm coming to you from the beautiful Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee, which is my office at home. And I just love working here. And thanks a lot to the Telos Alliance for providing some of the equipment that I use here, and also the time to do the show. I really appreciate them. You know, I work full time for the folks at the Telos Alliance, and what a great organization it is. We just did an internal company survey. I'm not at liberty to tell you all the results, but a enormous, overwhelming, like almost 100% of the people who work at the Telos Alliance say they would recommend that other people work for the Telos Alliance too. There's a lot of job satisfaction, and I'm delighted about that. Okay, let's get into the show. Our show is with a couple of fellows who are engineers, and one of them is also an entrepreneur, and we're going to let them talk about themselves coming up here. I want to introduce you to my friends, Brian Kirkin and Jim Hogue. Brian and Jim, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. Brian, you and I used to work together briefly at the Telos Alliance. You did some engineering and field work for us, and I know that you also worked for our friends at Salem Radio, but you've moved on to a really interesting and delightful challenge. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I'm working for a station that I've listened to for over 25 years. You know, when I have a vacation down here in Florida, it would always be the best station that I had heard in Christian music. So working with Jim is an honor. You know, this station here has quite a legacy, plenty of awards, and a lot of technology. And Jim has a lot of history. And, you know, if you're familiar with the Audio Prism, Jim was part of the team and a part of a company that designed that. Right, Jim?
In another lifetime, far, far away.
We're gonna hear some of that story in a few minutes. Jim, give me the elevator speech on Jim Hogue. You founded the company that runs WPOZ and some other stations in Orlando. What was your prompting to start a radio station?
Girlfriend. Who's not my wife? Isn't funny that, how that works. God isn't that works the reason? Serious ways.
Yeah. Well, and just a quick teaser. Now, I know that Nielsen, you know, ratings numbers are not something that everybody subscribes to, but over and over and over again, when I've been in the Orlando market personally and talk to other people in there, I keep hearing that frequently, not necessarily every single time, but frequently, WPOZ-FM is the number one station in Orlando. What can you say about that without running afoul of anybody?
You know, God works in mysterious ways. But you know, it comes down to doing good radio, which means you have good technology. It's a technology business, and people forget that it's a technology business.
Gotcha. Hey, we're going to get into some really interesting talk about early days with the Texar Audio Prism, some history that, well, I didn't know. And I would think that most engineers, at least if you're as old as I am, you're going to know what the Texar Audio Prism was. And you probably have some pretty good feelings about it because it was an amazing processor when it came out in its day. We're going to talk about some more history, but then we're also going to get into what you guys are doing right now in terms of virtualization, lots of IP packets running around and out to the transmitter sites, and just what you're doing to keep, you know, to make your station sound terrific. Maybe a couple of interesting things that folks like, wow, you guys do that? That's all coming up. Our show This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by our friends at Broadcasters General Store and Vox Pro. We'll be right back.
Yo, what's up? Live from NAB 2018. Hey, it's Caden. You need to check out Wheatstone and Vox Pro 7.1. The upgrades are amazing. If you're a jock, if you're a talent, producer, whatever, morning show, everyone knows Vox Pro, everyone uses Vox Pro, everyone loves Vox Pro, but now the features for this year, 2018, on 7.1 are amazing. If you're using version 4.5.6 and you go to 7, this is exactly what you're missing right here. The features are a game changer. It's going to cut down your editing time by like 80% depending on what you use Vox Pro for. And with version 7.1, introducing unlimited practic button bars right here, hotkeys right here. I'm going to show you coming out of a song.
Bad things. It's a lot of bad things that they wish and wish and wish and wish.
So you're coming out of your song?
Yeah.
Start your next song right here. It's basically an entire production room right on Vox Pro. So it's the Vox Pro we know and love with a ton more features. And now this is the ultimate game changer right here. Effect macros. So instead of hitting your effects button bar and going up here using your mouse for every effect, you do it right here with one click of the mouse, and you're going to cut down your editing time by about 80% without even touching this new sexy black controller. Check it out right here, Wheatstone Vox Pro 7.1 at NAB in Vegas 2018.
I don't know why you wouldn't want to touch the sexy black controller. That thing is popular. Vox Pro is available from our friends at Broadcasters General Store. You can give them a call at 352-622-7700 or visit them on the web. Of course, they have a web presence at bgs.cc. Five little letters and a dot, bgs.cc. Thanks, BGS, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, Brian Kirkin and Jim Hoag are here with us. And let's jump into something that most of us are familiar with. And for you young whippersnappers out there, you ought to be familiar with this. And that is the Texar Audio Prism. I remember first seeing this thing and I thought, wow, Christmas lights, and it sounds terrific. Jim, what can you tell us about your involvement with that amazing box years and years ago? What is that?
The first one didn't have lights on it. It was had meters on it. And, you know, it's funny. You walk into a radio station and say, hey, I got this audio processor. And they look at, oh, that's nice. You know, when can you clear the lobby? We put LEDs on it. We got a little different story, particularly from the general manager, who thought, well, that's cool. I got to go buy that. But the first ones actually had meters on them. There were 16 prototypes that were made, and we kind of bicycled them around to movers and shakers in the country. And in those days, a lot of them were on AM stations like WNBC. I think we sent a set to Chicago or one to Chicago for WLS. So in a few places, we actually went along to see what they thought. And but it wasn't until Z100 that, you know, the Prism actually grew some legs and took off.
Is it possible that maybe I saw one with meters in Pittsburgh? Maybe Bob Sharkey or somebody like that had one. Is that possible?
Was it? Yeah, probably. Or I know that Buddy Alo had one at V94. I think his were meters. Oh. We finally changed out when we got, you know, up on Mount Washington.
So what was your part in developing or being part of that? Because I always associated the Texar audio person with Glenn Clark. He was the name that the public name behind it. How were you involved?
Well, I mean, there's three of us. It was Glenn Clark, Matt Barr, who was at the time the field goal kicker for the Steelers, who was Glenn's roommate. And these were actually built on the kitchen table in Glenn and Matt's apartment. So we eventually rented a basement in a medical center on Salzburg Road and began to start grinding these things out. But it started real slow. I mean, we were making more money from optimizing AM directional arrays than we were from the audio processor. But we used a lot of the computer smarts of the DAs to design the processor as far as the crossovers and the and some of the logic on the back end of it to and it worked. It would control audio, and it didn't create any intermodulation distortion, and it was stinking loud with not a whole lot of gain changes. So it just did very intelligent gain changes.
You know, I was just thinking, a Texar audio prism is a whole lot like a four tower AM directional array. You've got a power divider and phaser controls, right?
That's exactly what it is. So we kind of understood that, what common point right here. So you
are there any cool secrets about the design that you could let us in on? Now, for those of you who don't know, the Texar Audio Prism was a multi-band audio processor, and as I recall, its claim to fame at the time it came out was that it had some intelligence. Most processors would either always compress or expand, and there was no in between. And the Texar Audio Prism had a third option, which was do nothing. This audio is fine. I'm not going to busy it up with doing something to it. So how did this notion come about?
Thanks to Walt Jung and his cookbook, but you also had Motorola at the time had the 4000 series TTL circuits out. And first thing we did was we linearized the compression curve, because when you charge and discharge a capacitor, it doesn't do it at a linear rate. So we figured out how to make that linear, but if you look at a processor as throwing a ball up in the air, if you're not compressing, you're expanding. The ball is either going up or it's coming down. The time that it hangs in midair is very short. We using logic, TTL logic, we were able to park the ball and then move it where we needed it to go as fast as we needed it to go in order to affect a change.
So,
as a servo loop, we had to look. You look before, what was coming in the card, and then you looked on the output to make sure that you made the right change. So that was different too, because most processors at the time were charging, discharging capacitors and just looking at the output. We were actually looking at what was coming in, as well as what was going out.
Most places that I either bought them or saw them put in. And by the way, the first time I came across Texar Audio Prisms was at a radio station that you may know the guy, Mike Gideon, had built in West Tennessee. And he was so secretive about what they were that he actually scraped off the painting, the screen printing on the front. And not only did he scrape the screen printing off, he then put it behind some smoky panels. So you could kind of see some lights back there, but you couldn't really see what it was. Did you have customers that were hiding what they were doing with the Texar?
Yeah. There was a few installs at one or two in the morning that were installed in the back of racks and in the bottom of the back of a rack. And they left either the plates off the front of them, or they turned the plates around.
Mm.
And put the set screws back in so that you couldn't see what it was. So, in fact, the first set that went into Orlando at the Nationwide station was installed like that in the middle of the night.
Wow. And as I mentioned, most of them that I saw were in pairs. They were in stereo pairs for stereo FM stations. But I also came across and myself purchased a few of them. That was the mono AM version, and it contained, as I recall, an AM clipper, a properly designed AM limiter clipper. Am I recalling correctly on that?
That is correct. The clipper was basically a reincantation of Bob Orban's smart clipper that he had in the 9000. And we kind of borrowed that, and we would look at the amount of current that was flowing in the clipper diodes, and then began to use a FET transistor to back out of the clipper so that you wouldn't overdrive. And it worked pretty sweet. NCRs, what was it? Help me here. NCR, NTRs, I'm getting NTSC mixed NRS. Up with
oh.
NRSC 5 wasn't kind to it. We had to go figure out how to preemphasize and then stop band the thing at 10 kilohertz.
Oh yeah, because we had that aggressive curve that we still have with NRSC for the preamp, and then the aggressive brick wall filter.
Yeah. Well, part of the fix there is we designed the card. We actually put a set of clippers because no matter how what we did, the thing would ring. We would have overshoot. So we put another set of clippers in to try to bring the loudness back. And by looking at the mask, we were under the mask. And we said, well, that's good enough. And in fact, this is great. And we shipped them, and we probably had the loudest box out there at the time. But I think when Russ Gettner bought it, he took a look at it and said, well, no, you can't do that. And he pulled that part of it out. And I think that it never was quite the same. So there's a big difference between the ones that were made in Pittsburgh and the ones that are made in Salt Lake.
Yeah, I had one experience with the ones made in Salt Lake and the replacement card five for an Orbin 8100. And I got hold of one of the first card fives where after being on for a while, all the plastic would melt and slide down and into the bottom of the 8100.
Was that the card five or was that the cobalt? The cobalt blue.
Oh, maybe it was cobalt.
Probably yeah. The cobalt blue. Yeah, that was designed in my living room here in Orlando.
Whatever I had came from Gettner. Now, maybe did Gettner make some cobalt blues or did they make some kind of card five that,
you know, Glenn showed up on my doorstep, one day and we're sitting around going, you know, back when we had Texar, we should have done this, this, and this. And next thing I know, the whiteboards are out and we're out, you know, and we're soldering and carrying on. And we actually got a prototype up and I ran it over to one of the local stations here in Orlando and the thing was just stinking loud. The problem was it ran hotter than a firecracker. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was epoxylated. The keep prying eyes out of it, you know, but it did run hot. Now, I don't remember the card fives running that hot, but they may have. I mean, you only have so much power supply, you know, in the 8100, the last thing you wanted to do was sabotage somebody's stereo generator. They can live without the prisms. They can't live without the 8100.
I hear you. I want to hear, Brian, some of your early experience with the Texars. Did you run across those? Did you have them on the air in some stations that you were engineering for?
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's how I met Frank. I mean, one of the things in working in Pittsburgh, it was a very competitive market. You know, we were going against Easy Communications, and Jim mentioned Bud Ello, and the audio there was a lot better than a lot of markets. So we not only had the Prisms, but we had the Vigilante, and we had some Jim Somage boxes, and I was building custom crossovers and doing modifications to 8100s, and they were interesting days, the analog days.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I know how we tweaked and worked, and really, we took pride in that skill. Now, of course, we take pride in a different skill, and that is taking these software DSP audio processors and tweaking on them. Brian, when was your transition from, when were some of the first boxes you worked on that were digital that you were adjusting algorithms instead of trim pots?
Well, I guess it would be the Orban 8200. You know, the 8200 was one of the boxes that I started to dabble with. And then, I've worked with a lot of different manufacturers, boxes, of course, with the Omnias, the Omnia, the Omnia 5, the Omnia 6, the Omnia 9, the Omnia 11, the Omnia 1, the Omnia Volt. I could just go on and on. But they're all good boxes. But, uh-huh. it takes a talent to adjust them, out of the box, working a stock preset, in competitive markets, there's a lot that's done to make a station have a signature sound. There's a lot of controls, whether it be AGC, limiting, parametric EQ, and being able to start with good, clean source content. That's why one of the things Jim is advocated is 24-bit 48 kilohertz. That's pretty much all we run here in the plant, and it makes a huge difference.
These are coming from the record company.
I want to
buy Nashville.
well, I live here. I want to talk about that topic. We're gonna have to hear a couple of messages first before we do. But Brian, you were telling me that Jim is fanatical about improving quality of source material, you know, what you guys will accept to put on the air and what you won't accept to put on the air, and what you say, hey, guys, go back and do this again. We got to have some better quality here. I want to hear about that. You are listening or watching to, This Week in Radio Tech, episode 457. I'm Kirk Harnack. Chris Tobin is out putting out a fire today, and my guests are Brian Kirkin and also Jim Hoag from WPOZ FM, and they have some other signals there as well. We're going to be hearing about that and their quest for really good audio. And also, we're going to talk about how they're using a lot of IP signaling to get stuff done. I'm amazed at what they're doing and delighted. And we're going to be covering that in a few minutes. Our show is brought to you in part by the folks at CalRec. We'll be right back.
Type R is CalRec's first native IP based mixing console. It is fully AES-67 and NMOS ISO-4 and ISO-5 compatible as defined by SMPTE 2110. Connectivity via Cat5e utilizing COT switches and power to the surface is supplied via standard PoE switches to minimize cabling. Its 2U core has integrated I/O, so you're instantly up and running, and it can power up to 3 independent mixing environments, each with their own separate DSP resources. Type R's surface is modular and expandable, consisting of 3 slimline panels, each of which are user-definable with layouts saved and recalled quickly between shows. It's available in 4 DSP packs, and as your station grows, larger packs can be added, making Type R the most flexible radio console you can buy. Find out more at calrec.com/twert.
Thanks so much, CalRec, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. And do if you go to the website, go to calrec.com/twert and let them know that we sent you. Hey, our show is brought to you also in part by our friends at Angry Audio. And if you've been told that these are not available, well, you've been told wrong. This is a few years old. This is an adapter from the folks at Studio Hub, and Angry Audio is now making compatible adapters, and they're making them in the same factory, the same place, by the same people are making these adapters now with the Angry Audio name. Here's the webpage for angryaudio.com/cables, and you can see for yourself that you have a whole selection of these beautiful Studio Hub compatible adapters here, these adapter cables, and you can get them either in the style that has the female RJ45 connector on them, or you can get the male RJ45 connector. So some people like to buy, you know, a 6-foot cable that's already got the male RJ45. Now, these cables, if you don't know it already, these are for wiring audio equipment with, you know, professional ins and outs, whether it's XLR or quarter inch tip ring or tip ring sleeve. You can also get the 3.5 millimeter or 1/8 inch stereo jacks. You can get that kind. You also get bare wires if you've got something unusual you're going to put on there. But so often in audio over IP systems, and also in the good Studio Hub standard, we're using Cat5 cable and RJ45 connectors, male or female. And this makes wiring literally a snap. You know how you wire things together with this? You go like this, tap, and you're connected. And look, it doesn't come back apart. And the connectors, lest you think there's a problem here, these are gold plated. They're kind of self-cleaning, because if they move a little bit, it's gold against gold. So it really works well. All of my stations are wired up with these. Oh my goodness. I rewired a production room recently. I put in an audio console, and I actually had to solder something because I ran out of these. Oh, it was so painful. Check it out though at angryaudio.com. You can order these. You can order these from your favorite broadcast dealers too. Just tell them you want the new, adapter cables, the Studio Hub compatible adapter cables from Angry Audio, and they will get them for you. Thanks a lot, Angry Audio, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, we're talking to Brian Kirkin and Jim Hoag from WPOZ in Orlando, Florida, a station that I listen to and have gotten to visit a few times. And let's see, we were going to talk about audio quality. Who wants to roll down that road first? Brian, Jim?
Well, in 2006, we converted to HD. If Steve Fluker is watching, then we have him to thank for it. Steve at the time was the director of engineering for Cox Radio. I think they had the Consumer Electronics Show in town. They were very anxious to get everybody in HD or as many people in HD as they could. Steve actually flew all the movers and shakers in for HD radio, and he was looking for a meeting room, and the SBE meets in our building, and he said, "Can I use your room?" And I said, "Sure, can my guys sit in?" So we were up to speed on HD before a lot of people were, and we ordered the equipment and installed it. But in the process of updating the microwave link and everything to the transmitter site, our director of engineering at the time, a guy named Randy Wood, says, "You know, we got a little bit of capacity here. The boards will clock at 2448. You know, we could clock 2448 to the whole building." So we started doing that. And then he wonders, he goes, "You know, I wonder if the record companies will actually send us, you know, the songs in unmastered 2448. And so we started asking for the music that way. And a lot of what you hear on the air on Z is a digital master at 2448 before really? They added the limiting or the hard limiting or the clipping.
And it's what? You mean you actually difference. Get files that have peaks on them?
We got files. And it sounds fantastic.
How do you do this? Is that a one-off that you guys get because you're special, or can other stations do that?
Other stations can do it. The record companies tell us that nobody else asked for it, but we know that's not true.
Okay. Oh, okay. All right. So you don't get MP3s or even AACs. You get linear wave files before they
2448.
And for those maybe new, that's 24 bits of bit depth, which is 8 more bits than a CD has, and 48 kilohertz sampling, which is a professional standard, not the 44.1 kilohertz CD sampling rate that the world's been living with for a long time. So, and I should point out that implies when you do 2448, you've got well over, actually you've got, I believe about 130 dB of, you know, peak to bottom available. You got a lot more dynamic range available to you. And so you can have softer passages and you're still way above the noise. And then the 48 kilohertz sampling, what that really implies is that when they have to do a roll off filter to stay below the Nyquist frequency, when they digitize anything, if they're doing this at 48 kilohertz, they don't have to have a brick wall filter like you typically have to have at 44.1. So you get less ringing, you get a more pleasant sound in the analog to digital conversion process. And I hope I'm not skipping over that too briefly, but that's long been, you know, one of the problems of 44.1, a pretty well a brick wall filter up there on 20 kilohertz.
Well, the biggest thing that it does, 48 kilohertz audio kind of fixes the FM pre-emphasis curve, because as you get closer to the Nyquist frequency, you turn in, you have more and more square waves, and you got a 17 dB boost at 15 kilohertz from the 75 microsecond FM curve. And so you still are pretty much a sine wave at that point, and you can hear the difference. The highest is sparkle. And now we're able to stream 48 kilohertz. Unfortunately, we're not able to stream the 24 bits. But what the 24 bits gives us is, if you're processing with your Omni 11, okay, and you got some stuff that, you know, the thing is reaching down 40, 45 dB to grab a very soft part. Well, you're getting closer to the noise floor. And the closer, the more you could drive that noise floor down, because what's underneath the noise floor is quantum noise, which is hideous. And again, you hear the difference. Things become very stark, very real, very in your face. We had one record company that sent everything in here. They sent us a whole catalog at 96.32. And we queued it up in the production room. We're standing there. It was, mercy me, Bart Miller. You know, I can only imagine. It sounded like Bart was standing in the room with you. I mean, it was so clear, and we bit reduced it down to 2448, and it sounded like somebody threw a towel over the speaker.
Oh my goodness.
We bit reduced it down to 16441, and it was horrible. I mean, it just, after you heard, you know, the other two high res, you know, particularly the 32 bit, it sounded like it was coming through a fan.
Wow. You know what? You caused me to think that for decades and decades and decades, audio has audio recording, transmission, and reproduction has been a compromise of the best we could do at the time and the bandwidth, whether it's analog bandwidth or digital bandwidth that we had at the time. And we're to the point where we're not really restricted by known quantities in audio recording, transmission, and reproduction. Not including the FM transmitter and HD, but I mean up to the transmitter, we're getting to the point where we're not restricted by known quantity problems.
Correct. Okay, I think the CD standard, you know, which Mr. Sony had something to do with, was mm-hmm. it the Orange Book? Is that correct? I'm trying to remember my history.
Yeah, one of those books: Orange Book, Green Book, Blue Book. Yeah, Red something book, like
you
yeah.
know. So anyway, yeah. I mean, he was a classical, you know, music nut, and he wanted to make sure he can get a whole symphony onto a CD. So right. that's why, you know, the first CDs actually were 12-bit. They did get them up to 16. Can you imagine 12 bits?
Wow.
12 or 14 bits. So they, you know, it was all a compromise, but the professional standard has been, always has been 2448.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so as you professional, said, run the professional standard.
and as you said, plenty of recording studios, because they can record at 32 bits and 96 kilohertz sampling.
In 96. We also got a few that will remain nameless there in Nashville who are recording on a laptop in an artist's living room at 16.41. Well, we're going, what are you doing?
That goes on to, yeah. And then the people yeah. who record direct to vinyl. That's interesting. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So. I don't know what sampling rate that might equate to. Some people say it's better. Some people say it's not.
It's a lot better. You know, I went through that transition at an album rock station, and you know, I had put a lot of serious money into, you know, Staten, you know, 681 triple E's. You know, you break the little brush off. You know, I'd change the styluses every 3 days. We changed the vinyl every 2 weeks. You know, 200 pounds of sand in each turntable. I was just nuts in those days. And, you know, so the sales department came in with a CD player, and, you know, the program director had a bunch of CDs he'd gotten from the record guys. And so we go, here's a laser cut from FM 105. We all hit the button. I'm not standing in the control room, and we all looked at each other and went, ooh, yuck. I mean, it didn't sound good at all.
So, you may have a different recollection. I recall one of the early CDs. There was a Billy Joel CD. I was working part-time at a rock station. I was their engineer in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And a Billy Joel CD came out. And we had been playing the same album on vinyl. And now the CD was out. But we could hear, to us, we kind of liked the CD. And, yeah, we did the whole laser thing or whatever. But we could hear buzz in a microphone on that album when the mix engineer would pot it up or pot it down. We hear the buzz go up and down. And on the vinyl, we never noticed that. Did you hear anomalies in the recording that were taken care of by the slop in vinyl, but you could detect on a CD?
What we heard was the high end, you know, was pseudo square waves, and we lost all separation. Because part of it was as the cartridge itself made separation just by the slop in the grooves. So all of a sudden I had to go back and figure out a way to do some stereo enhancing. And with the prisms, and thanks to Billy Sachs, I would matrix the prism. So I was running left plus right in one and left minus right on the other.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then I would tie the channels together except for the mid band.
Okay.
And that way I didn't wreck my multipath, but I still had very nice separation. And the PD kind of smiled and says, that's it. So as we made the transition to CDs, that's what we did.
Gotcha. Hey, Brian, we want to spend part of our show talking about, you know, current tech. Now, we've been talking about, you know, sample rates and bit depth. But at your stations there, WPOZ, and I'm sorry, you've got some other call letters there too. You guys are doing some very cool IT things. You want to kind of lead us into that, and virtualization is part of that. Can you let us know what you guys have found to be cool, efficient, and workable?
Sure. We're using VMware with Rivendell. So we have that going with Axia drivers. And, you know, we're using audio over IP, 192 kilohertz. And, you know, a lot of advanced technology with VLANs and just the way that our network is structured. Randy did a great job, I think, of setting the network up, you know, that we have in place.
Yes, as I recall, and we've talked to him before, you're stepping in after Randy Wood was there, and I met with Randy several times at POZ, and he was always pretty cutting edge kind of person too. Yeah,
definitely. I walked into a very good situation. I mean, this plant has a great design to it, you know, I'm just taking what he had as a foundation and moving it forward.
Talk to me, if you would, about your use of I believe you use Rivendell for your automation and a pretty cool implementation for EAS operations. What can you tell me about that?
Well, we have a DASDEC EAS encoders, and we have a custom application called EAS Panel. And what happens is the DASDEC, when it receives an alert, sends the alert and files to Rivendell, and the jock that's on the air will see the alert come up in a panel with the text, and it will also provide the headers in the EOM, and we can actually read the alert ourselves. So instead of having a computerized alert, the copy is there, and it's a much cleaner implementation. And we have a lot of systems, our lightning awareness system that we have tied to our generators, and our use of weather technology. Dean O'Neill, the vice president and program director here, operations and programming, he is what I would say almost a meteorologist. Wouldn't you, Jim? I mean, he's telling us about the early days where he would bring donuts when he was how old was he, Jim?
Like 14 or 15. He'd go down to the the Storm Prediction Center in Kansas City and sit with them and watch them forecast. So he started down this road of weather, and we rode through the tornado outbreak in 1998, and they came to us and says, you know, you guys were the only ones on the air. The National Weather Service weather radio had failed, and everybody else was kind of asleep at the switch. And Dean was on the air at one point underneath the console with the microphone, giving out weather warnings. So they made us the LP1. So it was something we took very seriously. But it wasn't until we got into some perceptual testing, and we didn't realize how well that tested with the public. So we just embraced it. So, you know, you'll see the weather warnings first, along with the safe and little ears, you know, out on the interstate, because both of those things tested very well in the marketplace, among, you know, non-Christians. And so that's what that's how the radio station became number one. EAS really is that important. Weather warnings are really that important. Serving the public is really that important.
Well, I think especially there in Orlando, I mean, my goodness, me and lots of other folks have been to Orlando, you know, once, twice, many times, and we know that lightning storms occur, it seems like, almost daily, and it's important to, you know, to be safe, to get out of the way of the lightning and know that it's coming. And you alluded to the detection of lightning close enough to you. What, do you automatically start your generators in anticipation of commercial power being interrupted?
We do. I mean, the system's in place where it will detect, and it pulls the information right off of the National Weather Service, and the generators start when I think that we have it set up at a 10-mile radius. Is that about right?
9 miles.
Yeah. And generators start, and we run through the storm. So
the idea is to get off the grid.
Yeah.
If we get off the grid, we can survive.
Wow. Wow. Here's a question for both of you. What do you suggest in terms of grounding? You've got an STL tower right there at your studio. What do you recommend in terms of grounding philosophy to keep things alive, even though lightning may hit? Sorry?
We use announcers. We keep them on their toes.
Okay.
You will do weather warnings first.
Well, oh!
No,
Everything's bonded. You know, I mean, the thing about it is that, you know, you got to ground it. You can't have differences of potential. You know, that's the thing. So,
well, some of this we found out the hard way where the differences of potential were, but the studio tower has caissons that go down in the ground about 25 feet. And we put the tower up ourselves. I don't know if I recommend that, but we had a drilling company come out and drill the holes. And of course you go, you know, 9 feet down in Florida, you hit water. So they pump in a slurry. We drop the cages in and then they pour the concrete in and it displaces the slurry. So they pump that off. It's pretty interesting how they do it. So I, you know, called up our friends at the Broadcaster's General Store and said, send me some 4-inch straps. So they sent us a couple hundred feet of 4-inch strap, and we wrapped these caissons in strap. And as they went into the ground, okay, and the concrete got poured in, that pushes the strap into the soil up against the side there. And that's the ground for the tower. And then as the cables go through the building, they actually go through iron pipe. We just took all the ceiling tiles out down the hallway and snaked this iron pipe up into the, the X bracing up there for the, you know, underneath the roof. And then the coax goes through the pipe. And then as it goes into the rack room, there's a grounding head there. Where everything ties back together again. And then there's a 4-inch strap that goes across the top of the racks.
I got to ask you about virtualization. Brian had led me on to believe before that you've taken some of your Rivendell systems and you're running them as virtual machines. How's that working out for you?
Well, it's working out real well. I mean, virtualization allows a lot of, advantages. You know, we were able to cut down the footprint in the data center, cut down on the heat, provide better reliability and better disaster recovery. You know, one of the things we're looking at right now, seriously, is cybersecurity and being able to harden our plant and make sure that that we have the ability to recover in a hurry. You know, with the stories that are out there that we're seeing almost every other day, with companies that are being attacked, you know, the concern is that, you know, music scheduling and traffic computers that are attached to the servers, being able to make sure that any of those attachment points, any of those shares, any of the data store that's vulnerable is addressed and secured and backed up, and that we have a plan in place to be able to get back up on our feet. You know, we don't want to be a cluster that, you know, there's been stories where, you know, stations just lose their whole library and they find out after, you know, CryptoLocker or another type of malware goes out and encrypts their whole library.
Wow. Yeah. It happened to me, but it was way before ransomware came along, back in the early days of the internet, when you'd order internet service from your provider and they'd give you, oh, 3 or 4 or 5 IP addresses, and they were all public IP addresses. And I didn't know what a firewall was, and Windows, I guess it, I'm not even sure it was Windows XP, maybe Windows 95 at the time, it had no firewall at all. And so, our C drive and D drive were just hanging out there on the public internet. This was in American Samoa, the station we put on the air there. And about a year into it, one morning they came in and found the D drive had been wiped. Thank goodness they didn't wipe the C drive, and the D drive was just all the audio, so we were actually able to put most of it back together. But wow, we have different times now. There's still threats, but they're more sophisticated now. How do you think that, and what resources might a broadcast engineer avail himself to kind of try to somehow get even with, or maybe even get ahead of the threats out there? I know the SBE offers webinars. Do you have any other suggestions?
Well, I mean, there's a number of different, resources that we're using. I mean, we have a local company, and an MIT actually is putting together a cybersecurity session for industry in general. But Wayne did a nice job with the SBE sessions. I think that's a worthwhile investment, you know, from what I've seen so far. The SBE does a nice job with its training. I think that more people should take advantage of it.
Guys, we're going to close our show out here at the top of the hour, and we've got one more commercial break to work through and hear from our sponsor, Lavo. And then we're going to be back with some final words. And if you've got a tip of the week for us, each of you, that would be just great. I've got a tip myself. I bought a cheap little, well, I'm not going to show it to you yet. You'll have to wait till after the break. You're watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech, episode 457. I'm Kirk Harnack in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. We're talking with Jim Hoag and also Brian Kirkin at WPOZ in Orlando, Florida. I sure hope to come see you guys around Thanksgiving time. I'll be down there. And I didn't know your tower was so well grounded, but it must be. That's pretty amazing. We'll be right back after this word from Lavo.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at. But have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the jock only uses once in a while. So why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like Auto Mix, an intelligent gain writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes, and enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavo radio tech at www.lawo.com/twert.
Thanks to Lavo for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. And Lavo.com/twert will take you right to their website with their radio products. Thanks again. Okay, it's time for our tips of the week. And I'm going to go first just because I got this thing ready and I didn't really warn Brian and Jim about a tip of the week. You know, I'm the kind of engineer who, I don't know, I never got around to getting testing boxes. And Chris Tobin talks about these things all the time. I'm always the kind of guy that gets out my volt ohm meter. And I try to, you know, coordinate sticking the probes into the XLR connector and holding a probe against here and holding something with my teeth and trying to look at the meter and see if I've got. And that's no way to test something, especially if there's an intermittent. You don't know if it's you trying to hold the probe on there, if the cable really does have an intermittent. Well, $26 Behringer, and other, there are others out there, and some are expensive and some are cheap, but for $26, I got this little Behringer CT100. It does do a test tone, but here, you plug your cables. Here's a stereo 3.5 millimeter, or otherwise known as a 1/8 inch, and you turn it on, and the intermittent lights show up right here, but you can reset those. Let's see if I can get that to show better. And what we're left with after you reset those is these three lights that are in a diagonal, right? There we go. Then that just means that tip goes to tip, ring goes to ring, ground goes to ground on this particular cable. And if I unplug it, then they go away, although the intermittent lights show up because they were intermittent for a split second. Reset that. You can also take an XLR cable like this mic cable right here. I'll plug both ends of that in, reset the intermittent, and look at that. You've got pin 1, pin 2, and pin 3 go to pin 1, pin 2, and pin 3. This thing also has it'll handle other cables. I don't know why it has TT connectors, but it does. It has MIDI connectors for those of you wanting to check a MIDI cable. Seems like a blast from the past. And then it also has RCA cables there, and also a quarter inch tip ring sleeve or tip sleeve
connectors on the front. There's a tone generator built in as well, and you can set it for tone. And by pressing the reset button here, you can make it go to a 1 kilohertz tone or a 440 hertz tone, 1K or 440, depending on if that light is on or not. So that's kind of cool. You know, a few years ago, I broke down and finally got RJ45 Cat 5 tester because, you know, you can buy those things for $7 now. They don't check for crosstalk. They just check for proper connections from end to end. So I broke down and bought one of these to check for cables. I've got an intermittent mic cable somewhere in my kit, and I've got to pull that sucker out and wiggle those things around and find my intermittent mic cable and either throw it away or fix it. That's my commitment to myself. That's that tip of the week. All right, Brian and Jim, what do you guys got for a tip? What's that?
Well, we have this little storage device. I mean, one of the things we're doing is with the cost of storage being so low, I mean, you can buy these for less than $100. We're just backing up our entire library. You know, even though we have RAID in place, you know, if something would happen, we could run, you know, right off of this as an attached storage device on a Raspberry Pi. You know, the interesting thing about Rivendell is how well it runs. I mean, there's an instance of Rivendell that will run directly out of a Pi.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing what you can do.
I was moving a radio station and we had some incompatibilities and moving. I ended up taking an old, a FAT 32 formatted hard drive, like the one you've got there, but it was FAT 32 because that was the only thing that would work between the computers I was using, and backed up the whole library. It was USB 2. So it took a little while and ran it across town and plugged it into the new machine. So yeah, USB hard drives are great. You can even leave them attached. I got some machines that are doing logging, audio logging, using just USB attached because it was easy. Good tip.
Why not? It's better safe than sorry, that's for sure.
Guys, we're out of time, and I appreciate you working so hard to get connected. I know you had a better plan for a cool camera, and our plans don't always work out. So I appreciate you backing up, punting, and finding a different way to connect in. So it's really good to talk to you. Brian Kirkin, the director of engineering. Is it Z Radio Group? Is that the name of the group there?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Jim Hoag, the president and founder of Z Radio. Thanks to both of you for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. And thanks a lot to our producer, Suncast, and also to the founder of the GFQ Network, Andrew Zarian. We're going to be back next week with Tracy Teagarden. We're actually recording Tracy on a different day, Wednesday. Next week at, I think, 1 p.m. Central Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll air the show live, but we'll also try to play it back at about the right time. And it'll be on YouTube as well. Hey, next week, Tracy Teagarden. After that, Scott Feibusch is going to join us in a couple of weeks. We got to go. Thanks again, everybody. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.